All right, what's up, everyone? Thank you for listening to Faith in Films, the only Christian podcast where you can mix movies with faith. I am being joined by Pastor Sam Crabtree, who wrote the book Practicing Affirmation. Hopefully you guys can see that. For some of you guys who will be listening to it, you won't have to worry about seeing. I'm trying to get that. Is it focusing? I don't think so. Okay. Well, he wrote the book Practicing Affirmation. So, Pastor, why did you write this book? What urged you, and why did you see this?
Well, thanks for asking, and thanks for the privilege of talking about these things. And not so much, my motive isn't so much to promote a product here as much as to equip people with something that I think really makes a difference in relationships and in a person's overall giving of glory to God. One of the things that prompted me to write it, I would say, was that for a number of years, decades, I had been teaching a pre-marriage class in which I would talk about these things, the dynamics around practicing affirmation. And I would have people who went through the class say, well, is there a place where I can get a book on this? And I couldn't really say yes. I mean, there were little smatterings here and there. And so one day somebody said, why don't you write a book on this? And one thing led to another, and that's where it came from. Accompanied by the fact that over the years, I have seen numbers of relationships unnecessarily damaged because people failed to commend the commendable in the relationship. And relationships, at minimum, grow dusty and dry and arid and stale without affirmations. And worse, they become hostile. They become negative. And maybe some of your questions to Josiah will get us to that here as we talk a little bit longer. But those were some of the motivations.
Sure. So I think probably before we talk about the book specifically, I think it's good to clarify a few things. So what is it? What exactly is practicing affirmation? What is affirmation? How do we do that? And how might that differ from what we would call in a secular society, self-esteem or building up oneself? How would we distinguish?
Yeah. Well, let me start with the last half of your question about self-esteem. This is definitely not promoting self-esteem. I would assert and allege that our culture has a plague of self-esteem. Me, me, me. We're all born this way. In the nursery, when we're at the hospital, and a baby's crying, he's not crying because that other baby over there is wet or that other baby over there is hungry. He's only interested in his own comforts and his own relief and his own advantages. And we grow up in that and we refine our skills at selfishness so that I would say, for example, jails today are they're populated with individuals who are all about themselves. It's all about me. If you own stuff, your stuff is my stuff if I can get away with it. And if you get in my way, I will knock you down because my way is the way that should be preserved.
Sure.
And it was G.K. Chesterton who said that insane asylums were the same way. They're full of people who are all about themselves and don't care about anybody else. So I'm not trying to foster self-esteem. Sinful pride is deadly in us. And so it's not about esteeming self. Rather, practicing affirmation, and the subtitle of the book somewhere in there is about God-centered praise of those who are not God. This is about esteeming the work of God in people. I observe and assert, and I write about in the book, that God is at work everywhere, all the time, in everyone, not the same way in everyone. He makes the sun to rise on the good and on the evil. He sends the rain on the just and on the unjust. So I'm not saying that everything that God does in everyone is salvific, that it's a saving grace, but there's a common grace that he gives to everyone. The smallest child, from the time they come from the womb and start breathing, he gives to all life and breath and everything else, including any echoes of character that they have. So a small child who maybe is not a believer, has maybe never even heard of Jesus, but does something kind to his little brother or his little sister, that's God at work in him. The fact that he can walk, that's God at work in him. Sure. The fact that he can digest his food and he can see and he can hear, that's God's benefits to him. And so what I'm saying is that we want to be on the lookout for what God is doing and affirm the work of God in others, including things that they do, behaviors that they demonstrate that we would call character. If you, I don't know if you have a window where you are there in your studio, but if you could look out the window and you could see the sky and you were to read the biblical text that says the heavens are declaring the glory of God, well, they are, but we don't always notice it. We don't focus on it. We don't pay attention to it. And it's the same with what God is doing in the people all around us, in our family, friends, coworkers, even the neighbors that bug us. God is doing something in them. And if we don't observe it, if we don't notice it and call it out and say, God is doing that in you, he doesn't get the glory that he would get. Sure. If we do call it out. It's like if I look out there and say, wow, look at that sky out there. God is really doing something magnificent. Or I look at the plants that I planted in my garden this year, the plants are just doing marvelous things this year. Sure. I'm so impressed with God when I stop and focus and look at the variations of color and the fact that these plants actually reproduce and they're producing oxygen for me to breathe. And sure. If I say, wow, God, he gets glory. If I don't notice it, he doesn't get the glory that he could get. And so it is in our relationships. If we don't see the things that God is doing and call it out and say, God is doing that in you. In fact, I would say, Josiah, you've started this interview with a couple of very good questions, like, why did you write it? That's a good question. And I think God has equipped you to be a good question asker already, and I haven't known you for very long.
Sure. Well, I appreciate that. Thank you so much. And I think it's important to make that distinction because I know my background, I grew up with relatives who were trying to sort of build up this sort of self-esteem, this view of yourself that almost was very selfish, me first. And that's not what you're doing. What you're trying to do is say, this is what God is doing. God deserves the glory for this, but he is working something good in your life. And I think that's an important distinction to make. So I think on page 29 in your book, one theme that I found that was recurrent, you said, our problem is we do not want strongly enough, desperately enough to be made much of by God himself for reasons he establishes and brings to completion in and through Christ and for his glory. We are nothing without him, but he has not abandoned us there. So my question from that would be, why do we find it so difficult to be encouraged by this form of affirmation? Why do our hearts want to steal the glory of God? And it almost seems as though it gives us a sense of autonomy while we read the scriptures, right? So how is it that, my question is more of how, I'm messing this up. Why is it that we reject this kind of affirmation? Because I found myself as I was reading the book thinking, this is not how I'm used to hearing it. I'm used to hearing, you're so good at this, you're doing such a great job because you're doing it. And I'm thinking, why is it so difficult? It's hard to shift my mind into this way of thinking.
Well, I'll speculate on why it's difficult. I think there are multiple answers. It can be complex in any given individual, but I'll try to simplify. One, you got at it when you were hinting at a sense of autonomy. We don't like owing honor to someone else. That if I do something good, it wasn't all about me. It actually was about others. I would say, for example, there's no such thing as a self-made man. I mean, I learned to ride bike when I was maybe 5 or 6 years old, but I can't say, you know, I by myself without any help learned to ride bike. I didn't invent the bicycle. I didn't invent the rubber that goes on the tires. And I had a father who pushed me countless times down the driveway. I didn't do it by myself. And we have, I think, in our sinful nature, we have a desire to let the honor reside in us. I'm the one who's so good. In fact, if I could take a little bit of a tangent here, I think one of the plagues on our culture is this idea that you can do or you can be anything you want to be. It's just manifestly not true. It's irrational to say that. I mean, I remember a number of years ago, one of our presidents of the United States made a speech in which he was talking to high schoolers across the country. And he was saying, look at me, I became president. You can become anything that you set your mind to become. And I thought, no. There were a whole bunch of people who ran for president against you and they didn't get to be president. And they wanted it very bad, worked very hard. I'm sure some of them prayed to become president. And then I'm a Minnesota Vikings fan because I'm from Minneapolis here. And when Adrian Peterson was a running back for the Vikings, he did a program for high schoolers in the Twin Cities where he said the same thing. He says, "You look at me. I just set an NFL record for rushing yards. You can become it. Just set your mind to it. Set your goal and you can become it." And I just wanted to say to him, then, Adrian, why don't you have a Super Bowl ring? Don't you want one? You can't have everything that you want because it's not all about you. You are utterly dependent. So back to your question now, why don't people like to think that God should get honor for the things that he's doing in me? I think there are some people who have been awakened to God and to his supremacy and his indomitable majesty and that he is utterly supreme. And so they have antenna now that have come alive. They're alert for pride. They're on the lookout for it. And to think that we should be receiving honor seems like stealing from God. Aren't we to make our boast in God alone, they think? And so I think one reason that they don't want to, quote unquote, as you said, steal glory from God is they feel like this is stealing glory from God. But if I can clarify, I don't think it is. In fact, I would say there's something defective with a person who does not want God himself to praise them if it's for the right thing at the right time. For example, what believer should not want to get to heaven someday and hear God say, "Well done, good and faithful servant"? We should want to hear that from God. And so you pointed to page 29, but if we were to back up to page 27, I give a list of more than a half a dozen things that are good for us to be praised for, and yet God gets the glory for those things.
Sure.
Like Paul said in his letter to the Corinthians, "I labored more than them all." So it sounds like bragging.
Right.
But he says, "But it was the grace of God that was at work in me." So he gives the credit to God. God did it. I did these things better than others, but it was God who did it, so I can't really take the credit. I have to pass the credit right on to God. So, to summarize, I think the two main categories of why people have a hard time with this God-centered praise of those who are not God is some are proud and they want the credit. They don't want God to get the credit for their lives. And some think that if they think, "Yeah, that I did a pretty good job. That was a pretty good podcast, Josiah." They think, "Oh, then I'm stealing credit from God." When if Josiah says, "But God helped me have a good podcast. He gave me the opportunity. He gave me access to tools, and he's given me experiences that have fostered my thinking along these lines. God has been at work in me both to will and to do his good pleasure." Okay, now God gets the credit for your podcast, and you're happy about that.
Sure. And I think that's an important distinction to make because, you know, I've talked to people, and I'm sure you've seen it. You'll compliment someone and they're kind of resistant to a compliment because they go, "No, I didn't do it. It was all God, totally God." And they kind of push back against any form of, "You did a good job there." So I think that's an important distinction. So you say on page 48, self-interest is not selfishness. Everyone knows to seek gain by means of someone else's loss is wrongheaded. But if you seek to be rewarded by enriching someone, that is not selfish. So in your book, you explain that there's a reward for affirming those. And so my question about that is, so we've made the distinction between self-esteem and practicing affirmation, which are not the same thing at all. And now we're looking at, okay, how do I do this in a way where it is not selfish of me, or I'm not seeking after my own gain. So I'm sort of using, in a sense, compliments to someone to sort of manipulate the way that they respond. So how do we do that?
It's an important question, and you're wise to ask it, I think, because the line between, I would add a word, I don't want to do it for my own gain. I think you don't want to do it for your own selfish gain, but there is gain in being selfless. I think the question that you're asking is, does this sense of I get some satisfaction or fulfillment or delight or reward from helping others, does that violate the law of love, which says love seeks not its own? You know, if I'm trying to get a reward, it doesn't that just contaminate the whole thing and disqualify my good deeds? They're not good anymore because, well, I'm going to get commended out of the deal. Well, I'd say no. It increases, this process increases our joy when we take delight in the fulfillment of others. Romans 12:10 says, now I can't remember what it says. It says honor. I got to look it up. Honor others. This is terrible. Good thing I remember the reference. Romans 12:10. Outdo one another. That's what I was looking for. Outdo one another in showing honor. Okay. So what I think of in my life about that is I make it an Olympic event at our house. So in the Olympics, the way you win in the 100-meter dash is you make everybody else lose.
Sure.
But when it comes to showing honor, if you outdo everybody around you in showing honor, what do they get? They get honor. They get more than you get because you outdid them in showing honor. So they win. You didn't steal anything from them by outdoing them. They get more honor than you get, and you get the satisfaction of doing it. And this is not a hard thing for parents to see illustrated in their own life. They love when their children achieve. They love helping their children achieve. And when their children do a good job, either just taking their first steps, or when they're a very young child and they, you know, oh, you're a good helper for mommy, putting the broom in the closet or whatever. The parent is getting pleasure and satisfaction from the achievement of that child, but it's the child who's winning, the child who's developing. So it's not as though I'm going to win by making you lose. I get delight in your accomplishments. It's like a coach.
Sure.
Who coaches a champion? When that athlete gets the championship, the coach is delighted, thrilled, pleased. We wouldn't say, "Well, that's selfish coach. What is wrong with him?" Nothing. He helped his athlete become a champion. Or as the Bible says, there's no greater joy than knowing that your children are walking in the truth. Now, when you help your children walk in the truth, and you get that joy, that's not selfish. Because you've equipped your children to walk in truth. What do you want them to do? Walk in lies, be deceived, get tripped up by falsehood and bad thinking? No, you want them to walk in the truth. That's good for their sake. And it gives you great joy. So it's a both and, not an either or. It's not a zero-sum game where either they win or you win. When you take delight in the winnings of others, you win.
Yeah, now this is interesting because as you just pointed to Romans 12:10, outdo one another in brotherly love. I just thought of a brother in Christ at my church who had started attending the church, and he bought me something. And I thought, oh, no, I have to outdo him in this in showing honor. And so I said, this would be a great way of going back and forth. And so I've actually made that my goal. So quoting that verse, it's clear that that's in scripture, right? Why is it that we miss that when we're reading the Bible?
Well, why do we miss 1,000 things that are in the Bible? I mean, I've been reading the Bible for decades, and it just repeatedly surprises me when I'll read a text and think, has that been in here the whole time? I've read the Bible countless times, and I didn't see that. And here it is, just laying there right out in the open.
Yeah.
So I'm not sure I can answer the question about why we don't see it, except we might be preoccupied by other things, or we might have been raised a certain way that kind of mitigates against it, or we've had bad models, or just absent models, just people that haven't demonstrated it very well.
Yeah, and I think that's probably true, that there may have been, in some cases, from what I noticed, in some cases there are bad maybe examples or not great examples, and but they're mitigating against what you're seeing. So you're reading the Bible, and I heard one theologian say that you know, we come to the Bible with theology, and the Bible interprets or corrects our theology. And sometimes we have this theology that it can't possibly be praising others. We have to be praising God only, in the sense that it's not thanking others for the work that God is doing in their life. And so it seems to be mitigating against some of those things that is happening in the scriptures. So I think this.
Yeah, I've had people thank me for a good sermon or something that I've written. And so to deflect credit to God, I've said, well, may God be pleased with what I just said or what I just wrote or whatever. And there have been people who have expressed affirmations about this or that. And to fulfill the Romans 12 thing, to show them honor, I just kick it back to them and say, well, you're very alert to notice the connections that I was making, or you're very kind to take time to want to commend somebody who said something or wrote something, and to observe that God is working in them, that they noticed that he was working in me.
Sure. So I think one point you make in the book about this, in the chapter where you discuss some of the mistakes you've made.
Oh boy.
So I'm gonna press this in. You bring in one of the mistakes is thinking that this is something optional, and you quote James chapter 3, I believe verse 10, on page 33, you say, to becoming Christ-like, admittedly, something may glorify God like heaven and rocks and not be Christ-like in the way people can be, but if a person grows in Christ-likeness, abiding in him by faith, that person will sooner or later glorify God, perhaps sooner and later. The reason we ought not to curse people are they are created in the image of God. We ought to affirm the likeness of God that we see in them. Okay, so important about that is that you're actually saying that this is a scriptural kind of mandate for believers to fulfill.
Yeah, I think it is. And it's not just mere or sheer duty or obligation, like, well, God has asked us to do this difficult, stupid thing of affirming others. It's not that. It's a fruitful thing to do. We reap benefits by becoming a person who commends others. We become more alert to the good things that God is doing all around us. We become more positive. We're more uplifting to the environment that we live in, the home, the office, the school, the wherever we live. People find us easier to be around. We become more believable because they know that we're not just some old crank who's always raining on everybody's parade, and you know we're Chicken Little and the sky's falling and it's all bad news all the time. We're not. To commend others brings benefits into our lives, including gaining a hearing.
Sure. So how do we do this with unbelievers? I've talked to many Christians. In fact, this seems to be a recurrent theme when people first come to Christ. They struggle with relating to unbelievers. They go, I don't know how to talk to these people. I don't know how to interact with these people. Why is it so difficult for us to do this with non-Christians?
Well, the same question. Why is it so difficult? There can be a number of reasons, but I think the difficulties don't have to be the same as impossibilities. I think a person can start doing it and get good at it. So here's a couple of examples. Here's a very street-level pedestrian way in which I habitually commend others is when I'm checking out at a store, let's say Walmart or Target or something like that, go through the line and I've paid for everything and they're handing me the receipt. There's, you know, there's this little console right there with the where you put your credit card and everything, and there's a little display window there, and I will lie to them. You'll get the nature here. I don't think it's a lie because I'm not deceiving anyone, but I say, oh, it says here, let's say that the clerk's name was Robert. It says here, be sure to thank helpful and intelligent Robert. And they know it doesn't say that. but they feel like, oh, they've been commended for being helpful and being intelligent and that sort of thing. And they know full well that I have not pulled the wool over their eyes, and it doesn't say that on the console, but I do appreciate their service in how they took care of their customer, which was me. And people that are in line start smiling when they hear me say that. And it's a morale building moment there. It only takes a moment. Only takes a few seconds to say something like that. Here's a little more serious example. I was at a public rally one time where there were protesters around the perimeter. And I walked the whole perimeter a couple of times, and my second or third time around, I stopped at one of the protesters who had a very artistically done protest placard that they were holding, a sign that they were holding. And I said to them, first of all, it was a controversial subject in a controversial context. And so it was easy for hostilities to erupt. And so I was trying to de-escalate that. And so I just said, may I make a comment about your sign here? I was asking permission. And they said, well, what? And I said, well, I don't know who designed your sign, but it's very artistic, very well done, whether I agree with the message on it or not. I just was commending the graphics of it. It was well laid out and the colors were appropriate and all that sort of thing. Well, that kind of commendation, I don't know whether the person's a believer or not. If I had to guess, I'd say, no, they probably weren't. I don't know their heart. But that gained an opening for a subsequent conversation that I had then with the content of the placard. And I didn't start out talking about the placard. I just was talking about the graphics, which were, in my opinion, quite attractive, quite attention capturing. So there are ways to commend unbelievers, and even in God-centered ways. I saw a man one time at a bus stop. Somebody dropped their bus pass, and the man picked it up and handed it back to them. And I said, well, that was very alert of you. I think God put you at this bus stop just at the right time so that that person wouldn't miss, you know, lose their bus pass. And so I think there's ways to talk to unbelievers and bring God into the conversation that aren't necessarily preachy. And I'll add this, that the gospel itself, people say, well, don't ram your religion down my throat. And I understand their feeling about that. And I don't want to ram my religion down their throat. But if I truly believe that God is supremely desirable, supremely valuable, wouldn't I want my neighbor to get the pleasure out of supremely valuing the supremely valuable? Because we love to delight in the things that impress us. And if God is most impressive by evangelism, I'm just asking my neighbor to get in on the joy train here, all aboard. You're going to like this God if you learn about who he is and come to love him. This is not going to be religion down your throat. This is going to be an everlasting relationship with pleasures forevermore at his right hand.
Sure. So I think on page 45, you share one of the common criticisms that people may hear, which is, and I'm going to quote you, you say, you left the lights on in the car, dear. Finish your homework, son. Late again. Not that way, this way. Individually, these are innocuous and one might argue necessary, but they pile up. And if not counterbalanced by an overwhelming gang of affirmations, they take over the flavor of the relationship. So before I ask you the question, I wrote a note to say this. As I was reading the book, I saw that the story that you told where you were affirming some of the things that your daughter was doing in her room. And I thought, this is such an incredible way to do this. And it's just in the little things that happen. Mm-hmm. So two questions, actually. How do we do that in a way where when we compliment people, they're not thinking, oh, you're flattering me. This is not a big deal. And yeah. So they don't receive it.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Yeah. Well, I think a key difference between God-centered affirmations and commending what's truly commendable, which, you know, Philippians 4:8, you know, think about these things. And then that list is whatever's praiseworthy. We're supposed to be commending what's commendable. A difference between that and flattery is that flattery wants some benefit from the party being flattered. So a young man comes along and tells a young woman, "Hey, babe, you're a looker. You know, you're wow. You know, he's wanting something from her.
Right.
That's flattery. But a grandfather who says to his granddaughter, God has really graced you with a pleasant countenance. You're just a pleasure to look at." Now, he could be a corrupt grandfather. That's possible. Sure. But he could also say that, and he doesn't want anything from his granddaughter. He doesn't even want her to say thank you. He just is admiring what God has done in his granddaughter, and he's marveling at God, and here's Exhibit A right in front of his eyes. The flattery wants something from the person that's being flattered. And that's part of what contaminates it. Even though flattery could be, in fact, true, there's a motive behind it that's corrupted.
Sure.
Go ahead.
I was saying, you actually make that distinction actually on page 38 of your book where you said, page 49, you said, though you quote Bion, or I think that's how you say the name, though boys throw stones at frogs in sport, the frogs do not die in sport, but in earnest. And so this quote actually helps us distinguish selfish refreshment from selfless refreshment, where you have a case where a person is, and I've done this mistake many times in my life, where you are... you're in some cases not complimenting, you may say something that you find it to be funny, but the other person does not, and you're making fun of that person.
Yep.
I had a situation months ago where I was living with a few roommates, and I would say, "Hey, you're joking at me, not with me." There's a big difference.
Yep, that's right. That's well said. Yeah, that's well said. I years ago in my marriage, I decided that sarcasm, though it can be funny, usually has a barb in it, and it may get a giggle in the moment, but it leaves a little wound, and those wounds pile up. And so sarcasm, unless the other party is totally on board with it and they have a sarcastic comeback, and you really are enjoying each other in that moment, but that's rare. By and large, sarcasm, I think, or double-leveled messages, now I'm making this up now, but it's a good thing that I love an idiot like you.
Sure.
Well, now, what is it? Is it good that I love you, or am I calling you an idiot? You know, and I think the idiot part cancels out the... I'm trying to say that there's endearment between us and there's belongingness between us. I think the person, and the more it happens, the more they're likely to shrink back and think, you really aren't for me. You're against me. You're evaluating me. You're judging me. You're keeping score on me. You're keeping a record of my wrongs. And in your book, I'm an idiot more than in your book, I'm a loved one.
Sure. So how do we make sure that we're doing this the right way? How do we look at people? How do we balance out, like you said, sincere, maybe playful humor versus making sure that the other person's inside the joke or on the inside of the joke rather than the outside?
Trying to analyze humor takes the humor out of it. And so I don't know, I wouldn't work too hard at trying to come up with the right joke. Although I highly value being playful with people, which is what I think I was trying to be at the Walmart checkout there a few minutes ago. I'm just being playful with the guy and commending the fact that he was intelligent and helpful in getting me checked out. I think just get started, just start doing it. Just start commending people for things that you think are really true. Now, if you say to someone, Let's just say that a woman says to her husband, "I just think you're the smartest man in the whole world." Well, if she doesn't really think that, he's going to smell a rat. He's going to wonder, you know, what are you up to here? And exaggerations are by definition false. And so that's not really building a good foundation. I would say that if she thinks he's the smartest man in the world, she should say so. And I don't know if our call just ended. Are you able to answer that question?
Yeah, I'm hearing you. Yeah.
Okay. All right. Because my screen you disappeared on my screen here. So just start saying true things that you find are commendable, especially if they have to do with Christ-like character. If a person is honest, if a person does something loving, if a person does something that is gentle and sensitive and kind, even if a person does something bold and courageous when they might have otherwise cowered, if a person does something that's very diligent, they've been doing hard work, you can commend those things in believer and unbeliever alike and give credit to God. I think, you know, when I see a grandchild share something with their sibling, a toy, and I say, God is helping you to become like God, which is generous. God is the most generous being in existence. And when you share your toy with your brother, you're being like God in that way, in that generosity. So anyway, I think people just need to just get started at doing it. Just jump in and be on the lookout for good things that people do and affirm them when they do those good things.
So how do we, I think that's actually great advice. And I'm really glad that you wrote this book and you are talking about it, because this is something that can really plague relationships. And
I think
insincere flattery or flattery can be just as toxic as sarcasm, because if you're talking to a person in a way where they're like, none of this is true, why are you saying this? And I had a few friends. I have a friend who keeps me accountable, keeps me in check almost. And he's not trying to do that. But I may say something that may be overblown, and he'll say, why do you say that? And it makes you give the reason for what you said, and now you're busted. So now you seem insincere. So I really appreciate that distinction that you make here. So on page 38, you say truth-telling and trying to show that affirmation, while important, is not the most important thing. You say truth-telling is more important than affirmation, primarily because kids may shut out all information. So when a parent is affirming a child, you say they may shut out all information. So what advice can you give to a parent who may not have been transparent with their child? I was just talking to a pastor's son recently, and he told me the one difficulty I have with my dad is that he's not transparent. And so any advice, it's amazing that you wrote this, because as I'm reading this, I'm looking at a conversation I'm having with a friend where he's saying, this is happening in my life where they're not being transparent. I don't want to hear anything from them. I don't want to talk to them. How can a parent, in this case, mend that broken relationship, and how can a child become receptive to that?
Yeah, well, it's a good question, and it's a painful one in many relationships that have found themselves in a hole. They've become bankrupt. Oops, I didn't shut off my ringer here. I've got to shut that off. There we are. The way to mend a relationship is apologize. I haven't been establishing the right pattern in my relationship with you. And then declare a repentance, meaning I'm going to turn. I'm going to be different. I'm going to start over here. I'm going to start commending that which is commendable. I will say that's not a quick fix. It will take a while. It's as though if you've been constantly trampling your garden, and one day you decide, you know, I'm not going to trample my garden. Well, the plants aren't going to blossom the next day. It's going to take a while for there to be, what should we call it, garden momentum or something. And so you have to be patient, and you have to be consistent over time and not give up. If I was going to say one sentence in this interview or if I was giving a lecture, let's say, on this subject, and people were going to write down just one sentence only in this, this next sentence might be the one that, that I would write down or encourage people to pay attention to. And it is this: people tend to be influenced by those who praise them.
Sure.
So one of the ways in 4 decades of pastoring, I've had numerous couples come to my office. And in my experience, I've never seen a couple get a divorce where they kept affirming one another. What happens is the affirmations go away, they dry up, they evaporate, they don't do it anymore. And all that's left is the little nitpicking and the little corrections and the things I don't like and the things I wish you would do different, and the things that upset me and the things that frustrate me about you. And when all of that negative stuff accumulates, it's like overdraft checks and your account now is in deep trouble. And so there needs to be a consistent pattern of deposits. And people will be influenced by you if they know that you're genuinely for them. In fact, John Calvin said that in his introduction to his commentary on Ephesians, that that people, if they really believe that you are for them, they will listen to you.
Yeah, that's really important, because I was giving advice to someone about how to correct others in a way, because we still have to leave room for correction at times.
That's right. Yep.
Mm-hmm. I was giving advice, and I was actually doing it the wrong way that you pointed out in your book. I was basically feeling this thing of, here are some good things that you're doing, you're terrible at this, and then here's some good again. And as you say in the book, over time, the person begins to develop sort of a, I call a social flinch around you, where
that's good. I want that phrase.
Every time they get around you, they either are very uncomfortable because they think, okay, here comes a criticism. And I've experienced this. You know, if I could tell a personal story, I was living with an aunt of mine, and I would buy food and I would buy things, and every time I would come back in, over time, it just became sort of a, you spent money, there's food in here. You spent money, there's food in here. You bought something again? And then I started to develop this, I'm going to eat out and not come back in, because there seemed to be a lot of criticism. So in one sense, my aunt was being well-intentioned. She wasn't trying to do that. And in some cases, like you brought up in married couples or even parents of child, they may say, isn't it my job to correct? I have to do this. How do you avoid overly correcting people?
Well, what I want to emphasize is that you may have corrections to suggest in another person's life that are absolutely right and godly and spot on. I mean, they're just right on target and they're needful. But what I'm saying is, if there hasn't been a consistent diet of affirmation from you toward that person, they won't hear your correction, even if you're right, which is why a lot of teenagers tune out their parents, because their parents have been kind of a conveyor belt of, do you have your schoolwork done? You know, hang up your coat. Don't leave your shoes there in the living room. You know, you're go to bed. You're staying up too late. How come you were late for breakfast? You know, just that's wrong. This is wrong. The other thing's wrong. And the teenager starts to get the impression, I can't win for losing with my parents, so I'm going to quit trying. I'm just going to tune them out. And that's when they start to get affirmation from some cute thing at school. And that cute thing now has power because they affirm.
And you know, that's really important, because I've said this for a while, even before I read the book. But I'm glad that you're confirming what I was thinking, in that I was saying, if you're giving, I would say this to my father, you know, I have a great love for my dad. But he would, over time, it became more and more critical. I said, Dad, when you give advice, the goal should be that the person hears your advice, not that you're just giving it.
Right, yes.
But some people can develop a sense of, because I'm in this role or in this relation to you, it doesn't matter how I say it, how often I say it, you're going to hear it. And there may be some validity to, it's true, follow it anyway. But there's definitely a way to tailor the way we do this so people are more receptive. We don't create some sort of a stumbling block for our corrections.
Yeah, you gain a hearing by commending the good things that people are doing. And we're all thirsty for this. We all want to be commended for things that we do, even if we fail in doing them. You know, the young wife who tries to cook a nice meal and it doesn't turn out so good, but her husband says, "I love that you were creative in the kitchen and you tried this. This is good try. That was a good effort." You know, well, she's more likely to try things again than if he said, "Well, that was burnt." That kind of criticism will close her off to him, close her up toward him. Whereas affirmations will keep the relationship open and fluid and welcoming. And the input of the husband who says, "Now, I love that you tried that. That was really good. And you were trying to please me." How many husbands would love to have a wife who likes to please them? "I'm so fortunate to have a wife like you. Now, it could use a little more salt." You know, that kind of, okay, that comment goes down way more easy than if he just says, "Man, this needs salt," and that's all he says.
Right. Yeah, that's certainly true. I have to thank you again for this book because it really saved one of my friendships because it was becoming too critical. And I you know, and this is something that I have inclination to do that. And as I was reading it, I said, I have to do this more frequently. I'm thinking, I had a sense that I'm criticizing my friend too much. I'm coming in too strong with the sword every day. I need to change this. And as soon as I started changing this, my friendship was restored. Not right away. It took a few days of
thinking
about it. And this is why I love it in your book. You actually, it's amazing. You write 100 ways to affirm people. Like, this is incredible. I was thinking, how can I do this? I said, maybe I should set up a time that I'm going to think about how to affirm my friend so that they feel affirmed. And I started to do that. And after a few days, I saw a relationship restored, which is incredible. And so I want to thank you for that. I do an essay. It's clear, because you were pointing to this earlier, the power of affirmation can be observed even in children amongst their friends who they're influenced by. On page 54, you say, "Consider the behavior of gangs. A young person may find that he does not get any praise from adults in his life, but when he sprays the bridge, the gang howls with joy. Guess who has influence over him?" So explain how affirmation, if not given by the appropriate person, can lead a child to following a wrong example. And in answering this is actually will be an encouragement to parents, but really this applies in all contexts to affirm people. So yeah. How can we do this?
Yeah, well, part of the how is just the Nike slogan, just do it. Years ago, I taught for a number of years in the public schools, and I discovered that I could take the most mischievous student, keep him after school alone, and help me do things around the classroom. You know, clean the back in the days we had chalkboards, if anybody can remember what those were. And you know, I could have him help me staple things together or move the furniture or you know, just help out in the classroom. And I could do it with one student, even if he was the most rebellious individual. But if I kept two of those rebels afterwards, oh my, what trouble. Because they just egg each other on. There's something in them that I can identify the other, and they reward each other's mischief. That's the thing. They affirm not what's good. Sure. They affirm mischief. They yuck it up. They laugh at each other's.
Oh, I laughed. That was me. That was me.
Yeah. And so then whatever the behaviors that get rewarded get repeated.
Oh, yeah, that's interesting, because that is exactly how it worked when I was in K through 4. I was really, you were just encouraging one another in iniquity. I would say to my friends, I would say, just like we encourage each other in righteousness, we can be encouraged in iniquity if we're around the wrong,
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
So I have another question about this, because I was talking to a relative of mine, and she said, and you brought this point up, she said, some people you just can't be nice to. You just have to come out there screaming, yelling, and they'll listen. And you actually talk about that in your book, about the way that maybe a football coach may correct his students. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Well, maybe I could tell the example of one of my students when I was teaching in schools. His name was, I'll use the name Wayne. That's not his real name, but he was a sociopath. And I had an agreement with the administration in that school that any fatherless boys that were coming up through the school, when they got to my grade level, I would welcome them into my classroom just because I was a male teacher and the other faculty at that grade level were females. It doesn't mean I'm a better teacher than them, but I happen to be a better male than they are. And I think these young boys just needed a guy. They just needed an adult male in their life since they were fatherless. And so here came Wayne, and he hated school, and he openly said so from before he came in the door the first day of school in the fall. I hate school. I don't want to be here. And he would carve the furniture. He would write on the furniture. He would, if you sat in front of him, he might write on you or on your clothing. He might cut your clothing or cut your hair. Nobody wanted to play with him during the free times because he just was antisocial. He just was trouble. And so I was convinced that this young man, I taught sixth grade. He was a sixth grader. I just thought it would be good for this young fella if he would listen to his teacher, which was me. And I thought, so how am I going to do this? Well, I believe what I said to you a little bit ago, that people tend to be influenced by those who praise them. So I'm going to find something in this guy that I can commend. And one day I had given an assignment and I was walking through the class helping students who had raised their hands because they were stumped on a problem or whatever. And I was always keeping an eye on Wayne because he was always in trouble. And in fact, I had to isolate his desk from the other students' desks just so that he wouldn't be injurious to anyone. And I noticed that even though he was not doing the assignment, he wasn't killing anybody. And I thought, I'll take that. He was just daydreaming out the window is what he was doing. He had his chin resting in his fist, in his palm, and he just was kind of staring out the window. So I made my way over there, not in a beeline, but just I kind of made my way around the classroom and came up behind him. And I laid my hand on his shoulder, and he jerked his head around and looked at me like, what did I do now? Because he really was always in trouble. And so what did I do now? And I just patted him on the shoulder and I said, I noticed, Wayne, that you're deep in thought. I like that about a guy. I like a guy who's a thinker. And I wish, I thought of this years later, I wish I'd said, it's God who says, come, let us reason together. God likes thinkers.
Oh, excellent, excellent.
But I didn't think of it at the moment. But I just thought, I like a guy who's a thinker. And I went on my business helping the other students, but keeping one eye on Wayne. And I noticed that he was, with his eyes, just following me around the room. Like, in that very moment when I said, I like a guy who's a thinker, he had the look on his face, I can still remember it, that was like, so that's what a compliment feels like. It's like he'd never had one because he wasn't good at music. So the band teacher didn't want him. He wasn't good at sports. So he wasn't on any of the teams. He wasn't a good student. So he didn't get good grades or good accolades. He wasn't getting commendation anywhere. And sure. So here comes a teacher who says, you're a thinker. And I like that. So I would make my way around the classroom. And when I would slowly turn to look in his direction, he would snap into that position, look like he was thinking again. Now what's happening there? I'm gaining influence. Yeah. He likes to be commended for being a thinker. Sure. And I tell a little more of that story in the book, but I think he was antisocial. He was a sociopath. I mean, he was trouble. He would ruin school property. I mean, he was trouble. And I've lost track of him. I don't know what came of his life. I'd like to say, you know, he became valedictorian and went on and had a call to ministry and became a podcast host like you are. Sure. But I don't know what happened to him. But I just would say that I was gaining influence on him by commending.
Really important, really important advice because, I even have I was talking to one of my sisters who recently became a born-again Christian, and we were talking about some of the issues within our family dynamic. And I said, one of the things is we're not used to affirming people. We're not used to hearing affirmation. And so, like you described with Wayne, there's almost a look of, did they just say this to me?
That's right. He was incredulous. Yeah.
And it certainly gains a level of influence, even for the gospel, very important.
That's right.
People are willing to listen to you. So there are, let's see. Okay, so two things. How is it that we can do this with our relatives, our kinsmen according to the flesh, who are not used to it? There may be a tense relationship, and it seems to be always more difficult when it's family members to begin this pattern. Easier to people outside, but how do we start doing it in a family situation?
Yeah. Well, here's a couple of examples. I was at a family reunion some time ago, and it just happened that there were some adults, happened to be women, in the kitchen fixing some food, and some of the teenage girls came in there, and I just said to the first teenage girl, I said, "Tell me something you admire about your mom." So I was inviting her to commend her mother. I wasn't the one doing the commending, but I mean, everybody just kind of stopped their hubbub. And they were tuning in like, oh, this is going to be good. This is going to be interesting. I wonder what she'll say. And so she came up with something that she commended her mother for that was a really good thing. And then I said, so, Mom, what do you really admire about your daughter? What is it there about your daughter that you wish you were as good as that at that as your daughter is? I mean, really elevated the daughter.
Sure.
And the mother came up with something. Well, you can guess that the environment in there was very healthy at that moment. And people liked, nobody said, well, this is a stupid game. Let's get on with slicing the meat for the sandwiches or whatever. And so then we went to the next young woman that was in the room and her mother and so forth. So that's one example of how you can just do it right out of the blue. Just, you know, what do you admire about your dad? Or what do you admire about your grandpa or whatever? The other one was, we had a different family gathering at Thanksgiving one year. And I said, well, before we leave the table, let's just go around. And when we get to person A, everybody at the table say things that they admire about person A. And then let's get to person B and everybody say things that you really admire about person B. And it was people were in tears at how significant it was to them, and how uplifting it was, and how important it was to them, and it became a memorable thing. Well, it's not hard to do.
Sure.
Nobody needs you don't have to read my book on how to do that. Just say, what do you affirm about that person? What are they so good at? Especially if it's a character quality.
Sure. However, I would say you definitely want to read the book. I got this book 2 weeks ago in the mail, and I was sitting in the car with the lady. My church, she just grabbed the book, and I was like, yes, here we go. And I just said, let me read a sentence in the book. I open up, and it has 100 ideas for those who feel stuck. And I went, oh, I'm in love now. This is my favorite book of the year. And the lady actually laughed at that. So if there's any reason at all to get this book, it would be the 100 reasons at least that we couldn't go through now, but 100 reasons as to how to affirm people. I've never seen a book more practical in my entire life that not only tells us what to do, but then
God
says,
be pleased.
How do we do this in a way practically? I've read tons of Christian authors where they'll give you a lot of advice, and the books will be good, and you'll say, okay, now how do I put this into practice? And this book does it. So that's incredible.
Mm.
One thing you mentioned is we want to avoid toxic reciprocity is what I'll call it. Having this idea that I'm affirming people, they're not giving it back to me. How do we avoid that?
Well, I think we need to, and by the way, let me back up on those 100 practical suggestions. I did have one guy contact me who had gotten a copy of the book, and he photocopied those 100 reasons and cut them into 100 strips. And he taped them around his shaving mirror, and he decided that every day I'm going to pick one of those, pull it off the mirror, and I'm going to do that for somebody today. And I thought that's a creative idea. Okay, now back to your question. You want to restate the question?
Yeah. How do we avoid what I'll call toxic reciprocity, where we have a fear that a person is, we're affirming, and people are being being commended, but it's not coming back to us, and so we get bitter about that. How do we avoid that?
Yeah. When Paul was writing about Onesiphorus, he said, you know, may the God of mercy be merciful to you, Onesiphorus, for the service that you rendered to me. So there are three parties. When you affirm somebody else, it's not just you and them. God is watching. And sometimes you affirm the other person, and the mercy or the grace or the reward comes from God. And some people would say, well, you know, isn't that selfish again? You're looking for rewards. I think God himself in the Bible says in Hebrews that you can't come to God unless you believe that he is and that he's a rewarder. You have to believe that he's a rewarder, or you won't have any incentive to come to him.
Wow. Wow. That's incredible.
And Jesus said, if anyone so much as gives a cup of cold water to these little ones, he won't lose his reward. Well, it's not the little ones who give the reward. It's God who gives the reward in God's time. So when you commend others, it will come back upon you. You will reap what you've sown, but God doesn't tell us when it'll happen or by exactly what means or whatever. You just have to trust God with it, that I'm going to go around and tell people what's good. And if they like it or don't like it, well, that's on them. But God likes it, and so I'm going to do it to please him. And it makes me a better person, and I'm easier to be around, and it helps me spend more time thinking about good things that I can commend rather than grousing about the complaints that I don't like and probably can't change.
Sure. So if you can give one final reason as to why we should begin to practice affirmation, what would that be?
Well, I would say the main reason is because God is glorious.
Thank you.
And he deserves the credit for what he's doing, and he's at work everywhere, all the time, in every molecule. An argument could be made. He's at work in us both to will and to do his good pleasure. It's all from him and through him and to him. So we should be commenders.
Sure.
So that he gets the honor that he deserves.
Well, Pastor Sam, I thank you so much for coming on Faith and Films to discuss practicing affirmation.